Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So let's get started. What are we going to be talking about today, Peter?
Well, I guess this talk is called Embodied Rewilding. So that's what I'm going to talk about. when I was approached to talk about this, that seemed to be the most relevant to the conference. So before I do any of that, I would just like to acknowledge that I'm sitting today on the territory of the Chinook and Multnomah people that is now called Portland, Oregon. So let's see here. I wanna, it's funny when the description of this talk had those little icons at the bottom and it had a little picture that said like movement not required, and it was like a person hunched over in their chair. I just thought that was kind of hilarious to have a embodied rewilding discussion in chairs like this without any movement. But of course, here we are on the internet watching a video, and the last thing I want to do is some sort of aerobics type thing where, you know, I'm having you do movement. So ideally what we're going to talk about today are things that are going to inspire you to live an embodied and mobile, you know, if that's something that you can do, part of rewilding. So, you know, another part of that aspect was, you know, content warning at the bottom. And it's important for me to just kind of always put a content warning or trigger warning at the beginning of anything that I talk about in regard to rewilding, because rewilding is really about exploring the fundamental aspects of our society, which are inherently destructive and violent and have done a lot of damage and trauma to us as individuals and as communities and as larger people and other than humans. And so a lot of this conversation around what rewilding is, it's a direct opposition to a lot of that trauma that is inflicted on us. And so it's just important to kind of think about that before we delve deeply into this, because I don't know where everybody is at with that. And, you know, this isn't going to be one of those talks that's just like a bunch of life hacks for you to write down and then go do. This is going to be a sort of a very brief, deep dive into some of the concepts around what it means to rewild. And those can be highly painful when we start to recognize just how much pain civilization, our society at large, not civil societies of humans, but how much pain domestication has caused all of us. So just kind of getting those things out of the way right to start. And I want to talk about what rewilding is. So rewilding, you know, it's kind of nowadays, it's sort of one of those bullshit buzz terms. I see people kind of co-opting it to sell all their different, you know, branded, whatever, capitalist supplements and things like that. You know, that's okay for whatever that is, but there's something that's much deeper that's going on. And the people who sort of have been working on this rewilding movement for a long time have been maintaining that depth and breadth of what rewilding means. So when you really get into it, you have to understand what wildness is. Like, we got to break down the word, you know, rewilding. It's actually a word that you know, I don't like the word, even though it's something that I've dedicated my entire life to. The word doesn't do service to the actual thing. The word can confuse and draw people away from what we're actually trying to accomplish with it. So really a large part of it is about unlearning and relearning what wildness is. And if we look at the word wild, we can kind of understand the etymology of that comes from will and willed. So the willed animals, when you domesticate an animal or you tame an animal, it's the process of breaking the will of that animal so that you can control it, or that plant, so that you can control it to the fullest extent of its existence for humans to consume. So when we think about wild animals, those are the willed animals that are out of the control of specifically humans. But in this process of domestication, that who knows exactly when it started, you know, agriculture and domesticated plants and animals, we can see that happening 10,000 to 5,000 years ago, even 12,000 years ago, and a sort of a gradation of that process of control and essentially domination. Domestication and domination have that same root, dom, which is the house. So to domesticate a thing was to bring it into the house. In particular, that has to do with animals in the Neolithic, bringing them inside at night so they wouldn't have predators kill them in the evening. Getting on a side tangent there. Normally this class, I have a rewilding 101 class that I teach that's online now due to the pandemic, and it's like 4 weeks, and that's still not enough to cover all of the content in regard to truly understanding or even just trying to get into this quest of what wildness means and what rewilding means. So the re in wild is very important because it recognizes that there's been a separation, whether that's, you know, a psychological separation that then has led to our emotional separation, spiritual separation, that doesn't really exist on a larger scale outside of our imaginations. But when we have that separation in our imagination, we embody it and create the separation in the physical space, right? So throughout the process of this belief system of humans being separate from wildness or trying to control the wildness, we've basically enacted that mindset across the whole planet. So we've alienated ourselves from the ecosystems that we were once a part of. And obviously as an individual, I'm not rewilding. I was never part of an ecosystem. I've been a subject of agricultural states since my birth. So in the sense of re, it doesn't mean for me as a settler living on indigenous land here in Portland, Oregon, it doesn't mean that I'm rewilding in a sense that I'm finding my wildness here in the space again, because obviously I've never had it here, but rather the relationship to the will that my ancestors had prior to the innovation of agriculture and domestication. So if you can see that sort of, that's sort of it in a nutshell, right? There's no like 30-second elevator pitch for this, because it really is deconstructing the entire cultural mythology that we're born in. And in the same way that fish don't talk about water, we don't really understand or even talk about the mythological framework that we swim in as quote unquote civilized humans. We just project these ideas. And so in order to embody rewilding, really what it is the embodiment of a new narrative about who we are and what it means to be human. So you can't rewild without actually having that story to embody. You can't actually enact something in the physical world and embody it in yourself until we have that story to actually enact. And I think about it in terms of like what Joseph Campbell might call mythology and ritual enactment. So you have the cultural mythology on the one hand, which is the story, and then it becomes an embodied practice through quote unquote ritual enactment. And you could, you know, look at that definition as broadly as you want, everything from, you know, believing that humans should, you know, having the mythological narrative that humans should be fruitful and multiply as a story. And then when you embody that story, you have a lot of children, or you work in those practices to do that, right? So embodiment isn't separate from the narratives that we exist within. And so rewilding is about reframing wildness in order to have an embodied practice of what it means to be living within an ecosystem in a regenerative way, in a way that we fit in, not that we dominate, but rather that we coalesce with, right? So in regard to that embodiment and specific to this conference, the process of domestication and that separation has caused humans, as well as the ecosystem and other than humans, psychological trauma, emotional trauma, physical trauma. And those are kind of the areas that a lot of people like to focus on. And because it's easier to give people sort of life hacks than it is to restructure this narrative to embody, we end up having some of those life hacks sort of take the stage. You know, it makes me think of like, an example might be paleo diet. You know, now you have like these paleo diet bars that you can buy at the store, and I totally buy them and eat them. I'm not harping on that in any way, but just that's not like the embodiment of cultural practices of paleolithic diets. If they're, you know, now people starting to transition that language to ancestral diets and things like that, but rather than being this sort of prescriptive thing that you can then sell in a capitalist framework, that it's a whole system that requires transformation. And if you're not focusing on that whole system, then you're really only helping yourself, and it ends up being a pretty selfish endeavor. That's not to say that we should neglect ourselves in any way at all. So in regard to health and domestication, there are some really important things to know about how the process of domestication has affected our bodies, and work as much as we can around those within the framework that we have, so that we can do this larger cultural work. Because all of the aspects of domestication that have affected us, you know, I think about our sleep cycles being disrupted, our diets being disrupted, our movement being disrupted, our psychology being disrupted. All of those things are byproducts of living in a domesticated society. When I did not coin the term rewilding, but I coalesced multiple definitions on the internet into a singular definition that is now in widespread use. And I did this back in 2006. And the definition was: to rewild is to return to a more natural or wild state, the process of undoing domestication. And, you know, when I coalesced that definition, I had only been really into rewilding for a few years. And so now, you know, 14 years later, looking back, I recognize that that was essentially a mistake to look at rewilding as undoing domestication rather than embracing wildness. And why that's important is because wildness is an undefinable thing that we can try to attain. And there's a word in the UK that's not really used in the United States, but I found it one day and I thought it was hilarious and I loved it. It's called tokkaddiwampal. Tokkaddiwampal is to purposely move toward a yet unknown destination. And to me, that's the perfect kind of description of what rewilding is. It's the purposeful movement toward wildness, but we can't actually define what wildness is. We can, though, understand that if we try to undo domestication, that we can end up repeating the same processes that we, the mistakes that we made through domestication, which is trying to control for the outcome rather than embracing that we don't have the full-on understanding of what wildness is. We try to control for it, and that is undoing domestication. So now when I think about rewilding, the most simple definition I have is the embrace of wildness. Of course, then people, you know, need to understand that wildness doesn't mean completely uncontrollable, crazy anarchy, the way that, you know, people project that idea onto anarchy. Anarchy just means stateless peoples, you know, it doesn't mean chaos. And so I think of that in the same way as wildness. Wildness isn't uncontrolled chaos. It's flow systems operating together communally, sometimes competitively, but always sort of operating on a sense to find balance. And when we started domesticating things, we basically broke the balance. We started creating these like hacks to try to control the entire system. And what we saw was a decline in our own health dramatically. So with the advent of agriculture, immediately there's a huge nutrition loss when people switched to grains, because the diet is high in calories but lacks nutrition. So immediately you see osteoporosis. You see a bone density just being, falling through the roof. You see cavities and skeletons with teeth falling out. You have heart disease, diabetes. The majority of health problems that we have today that are the most common are actually created by civilization. And we like to project this idea onto the past that we've somehow, climbed our way out of the muck of wildness, and we've tamed the world in a way that now we benefit from. But the reality is actually the inverse. In trying to control things, we've made our lives that much worse in a million different ways. And so, embodied rewilding doesn't just look like, wearing barefoot shoes, is essentially what I'm trying to get at here. That could be a part of your practice of rewilding in regard to your personal body. But really, systemic rewilding would be getting a sledgehammer and tearing up sidewalks and going barefoot again and ceasing to pave and transform the environment so that we can have diverse movements again as we glide across the landscape. So I've got my list of things here. I'm kind of jumping in and out of things.
There's a question, if you'd like to answer it. Tia has a question. Do theorists have a specific rationale about why so many communities in different locations on the planet began orienting around an agricultural domestic separation direction?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, there's a lot of theories around it, but it's hard to understand why, because the amount of labor that goes into agricultural societies is so much higher than non-agricultural societies or hunter-gatherers and horticulturalists, that there's it's something that stumps everybody. And it's kind of that thing of like, we understand how agriculture comes about. Like, I know how my heart pumps blood and my organs absorb blood, and there's this process that goes back and forth, and I know that like electricity exists in my brain to do these things. But we don't know how to like bring somebody back to life, even if all of their parts are working. You can send that electricity, you can do that stuff, but it still doesn't explain what the thing is that is alive in our body, right? So we know that, in order for an agriculturalist society to be generated, it has to be in a geographical place called the alluvian plain, where the seasonal disturbance cycle basically grows grains not year round, but season to season. And it's limited to that because of the natural flooding. So, we're talking about the Tigris and Euphrates River. Obviously everybody knows, like, people call that the cradle of civilization. It's not, it's one of, dozens across the planet that all kind of arose within 1,000 to 2,000 years of one another. The Mississippi Delta complex was a massive agricultural civilization here in North America. Obviously the Amazon basin, the alluvian plain in South America is actually in the Andes, is at 10,000 feet. It's not at sea level. And so at that alluvian plain is where you get the Inca, because they could grow quinoa and things like that. And of course the Yangtze River, and there's just all over the world in these alluvian plains where annual grains grow. That's sort of the impetus to start these societies. But the main spark of life that makes them end up being perpetuated and then expanding into colonial civilizations is something we don't quite understand, because it doesn't, anywhere that that has happened. People haven't just started farming because they thought it was a great way to live. Everybody who's a hunter-gatherer rejects the idea because of the amount of labor that is involved in farming. It's ludicrous. Why would you, you know, there's the classic quote from the Bushmen that's like, why would you plant crops when there's so many mongo nuts in the world or whatever, which is a famous quote from a Bushman in the 70s when they were asked, like, why don't you start farming? And we see this everywhere. It used to even be projected because the hunter-gatherers of Europe were slaughtered or went, you know, died off mostly 7,000 years ago. The perception was actually that the hunter-gatherers of Europe just started farming for the hell of it or because it was a better way to live. And now with DNA sequencing, we know actually that the hunter-gatherers of Europe were physically replaced by agriculturalists that were colonizing that space 7,000 years ago. So, you know, it's one of those things where we can understand how it happened, but not the thing that made it like sticky, if that makes sense. Like other than just the sense of hierarchy and state societies getting to the point where they had enough population density that they could really enforce a military conquest on other people. And then it becomes a self-perpetuated system where people in power have the resources to maintain that power through violence, through their armies.
You see, Tia has another question. I'll let you read it to make sure it gets recorded.
Where is it?
It's in the Q&A. I'll read it. She says, could have been different reasons in different places. Hierarchy comes after agriculture, though.
It's not necessarily, hierarchy comes just potentially with population density and surplus. So, you know, the Northwest coast and the Northeast coasts of the Pacific Ocean were huge larders of natural resources for humans in regard to fish runs, clam beds. And hunter-gatherers in those places didn't even really need to have nomadicism. They could just be sedentary because instead of moving to their food resources, the resources flowed around in these particular places. And so what we see with human societies is the more sedentary and the more food surpluses that exist ends up becoming hierarchical. That's just sort of one of those things of like, are humans naturally violent or are they naturally egalitarian? Well, what we see is in certain circumstances, different behaviors come out of us, right? So there's this whole concept of environmental psychology, basically. You know, what is the kind of environment that produces what kind of behavior? You know, there's people who study this specifically. And a contemporary example is they realize that if inmates in prisons had like pink or purple uniforms or jumpsuits or whatever, that there was a decrease in prisoner conflict. And so now in a lot of those maximum security prisons and in prisons, you see that color being adopted to their clothes because environmental psychologists have studied it. And, you know, if it works, it works. Like, but why, I don't know. And so in the same way, when I think about, you know, what's the human nature is something that we'll never understand. It's so complex. And we can be violent, we can be peaceful, we can be all kinds of things depending on what the environmental conditions are. And so to me, rewilding is a couple of things. One is it's trying to understand the evolutionary environment of adaptation or the environment of evolutionary adaptation. So what are we most adapted to biologically, culturally, spiritually, physically, right? And the paleo diet is like one of those interesting tangents that ended up becoming leading into rewilding for a lot of people. Because you go down that rabbit hole with your diet, you're going to end up expanding it to everything else, right? So really, you know, what is the thing that we are and the life ways that we're evolutionarily adapted to? And if we go back far enough, you know, we can see that humans lived in relative equality and egalitarian societies for millions of years, potentially. That's not to say always or all the time, or that there's no such thing as violence in certain societies, or that it couldn't arise even in that. But just rather that that's in the same way that the principles that we call the paleo diet, even though it's not a diet, it's a series of principles around it. In the same way that there are those principles around the diet, there are principles around our behaviors and expectations that we have within our life as creatures, you know. And so rewilding is really about studying and trying to understand what was the environment of evolutionary adaptation so that we can know what's the best expression and most healthy and vital and regenerative and resilient expression of humanness. Not to say that we can go back to whatever that was, because we can't. The environment of evolutionary adaptation is gone. We evolved with megafauna species that are mostly extinct now. And so all of that environment has changed. We live in a completely different world, but we're still evolved physically, spiritually, emotionally, all of those ways, you know, collectively for that era. And now it's about understanding where we came from and trying to figure out how to adapt to the contemporary situations we find ourselves in order to get those needs met that we know we need in our own lives, in our communities, beyond just human, right? And human and other than human communities as well. So that we can just continue this process of natural selection, but without doing so much damage to ourselves and to the rest of the world. And to me, that is through this process of finding, of really looking at what its willedness, right? Because it doesn't matter what the environment of evolutionary adaptation was, because we don't exist in it now. But what does exist throughout that whole thread is wildness, because wildness is really about adaptation and adapting to the changes in our environments. And so our environment has changed, but we're still under these expectations of millions of years of evolution. And our environment's going to continue to change, and we're going to continue to adapt to those changes, right? But if we're not thinking about it in these terms, and we've been inculcated in domesticated societies, then we're going to look at domesticated solutions. And so I think about this, especially with things like, the life hacks, like barefoot shoes. I love barefoot shoes. I own pairs. I like that I can feel the ground with them. I like that in the summertime, if I can't go barefoot, I can put on a shoe and walk around the city without absorbing all of the toxic shit through my feet. You know, when I was a teenager, I went barefoot for a year in the city. And every day at the end of the day, my feet had tar covered on them from the asphalt. And your feet are highly absorbent. And so I was just absorbing that shit into my body, right? So when I think about that, I think about the environment of evolutionary adaptation was great. What am I designed for? And what do I live in? What society do I live in today? And how can I start to break down the culture of domestication so that we can end up adapting to a more resilient system? Because the whole point of this is really that wildness is, because it's adaptive, it's the most resilient way to live. And when you start to domesticate things, it's non-adaptive. It's about living in a static state, a fixed state, where you want predictable grains every year, instead of letting a forest come back and do, Swidden agriculture or slash and burn agriculture or regenerative agriculture, horticulture, permaculture. Those are all kind of the same, under the same umbrella of subsistence strategy that works with the flows of succession, where agriculture, specifically when it's exported out of the alluvium plain through irrigation and tilling of the soil, is about suspending forest succession in the meadow. Agra means field and culture means to cultivate. So to intentionally create a field, and all of those fields are annual crops who don't really grow deep roots. Whereas natural grasslands like the Eurasian steppe or the plains in North America were actually perennial plants, perennial grasses whose roots go down like 60 feet. And oftentimes those perennial grasses can store more carbon than an old growth forest in the soil. So you have these the process of domestication is about trying to control and freeze this system that needs to be cyclical. It needs to burn, it needs to transition and build soil. And, you know, if you look back at the beginning of the Neolithic, which is the, you know, agricultural revolution, so-called agricultural revolution, we can see the climate would have gone into an ice age, but instead starts to flatten out in a way that it hadn't before. And people say, oh, we entered a temperate climate, and that's what allowed us to do agriculture for 10,000 years. But the reality is probably that deforesting and losing soil caused the carbon that was stored to be released into the air and actually caused the earth to flatline in terms of temperature. So, you know, there's a great book called Plows, Plagues, and Petroleum, How Humans Hijacked the Climate, I think is the subtitle, that outlines how this process happened and that the carbon cycle that we think of with global warming actually started with agriculture. And there's, you know, more evidence of this too in regard to, you know, when Genghis Khan went through Eurasia and slaughtered agricultural societies, the areas reforested and the world's temperature dropped 2 degrees, I believe. And the same thing happened when colonization of North America by Europeans happened, and a lot of native people here died of disease. Their agricultural civilizations collapsed, and there was a mini ice age in Europe because the world's temperature started to drop again through reforestation. So who knows what that means in regards to larger climate change stuff, but the carbon cycle here in regard to wildness is about putting that back in the soil and storing that carbon, getting off track here. And there's a lot to talk about with all of this, right? It overlaps. Are there any other questions?
I don't see any questions at the moment.
In the chat box. You know, so thinking about our domestication on both an individual level for your personal health, but also as a collective level, because I practice a lot of personal aspects of rewilding, but I don't talk about them all that much because to me, an example is if I walk into a house and there's 10 people watching TV, nobody else, and there's nobody for me to talk to, they're all watching a show, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna sit down and start watching the TV, right? That's just, for me, the idea of willpower to get out of that culture is super challenging and I'm subjected to it. So for me, embodied rewilding is great on an individual level, but it's not really the embodiment of the whole narrative. And so I want to talk about like techniques for embodied rewilding. And it really starts out with uncovering the story, which then you can embody. If you don't have a story to embody, you're just embodying the same story that we've been telling ourselves for years. So the first part of rewilding isn't necessarily, you know, going to your sit spot as much as it is having a new story to live by.
You want to talk about what a sit? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
If you're unfamiliar with the term sit spot, a sit spot is essentially a practice where you go to the most biodiverse place you can find and you just sit there on a regular basis. You know, in a city, it can be more challenging, but it can even just be sitting at your window if you live in an apartment and looking out the window. Or if you live out in the countryside, it could be going to a forest and sitting in the forest. The idea being that if you can find a more biodiverse place, it's unnecessary, but the idea being understanding that there is a world of wills enacting their existence outside of human control. And that starts to shift your mindset into recognizing, oh, there's other things living here. How am I influencing with them and how can they influence me? The sit spot is essentially an embodied practice of animism from my perspective, of observation, awareness, and having a sense of place. Sense of place is super important to rewilding. But for me, in order to inspire me to go to the sit spot, in order to be in those places, I first need to have a cultural lens that shifts my value system, that shifts the narrative about what it means to exist with all of these other wills in an ecosystem. And so, you know, before I go to my sit spot, I actually even need to know that a sit spot exists. I need to know, you know, all of these other things that are going to help me along the way. And so to me, you know, as a cultural animal that grew up with a story, the first aspect of rewilding is unlearning what we've been taught, learning the new narrative to be in, understanding what domestication is, understanding what wildness actually is, not this uncontrollable, aggressive energy, but a flow system of fittedness into an ecosystem. Understanding that there's an equilibrium, it's not just about humans dominating, but how we are also influenced by the things in our ecosystem and how those things change us, that there's a back and forth relationship there of mutual aid, not just consume, 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 control, control for me to eat, which is essentially what domestication is.
You mentioned the word animism in passing. Did you want to define that? I'm going to be your definition sheepdog.
Yeah. So animism, you know, a lot of people look at animism as like a religion. To me, it's not a religion. To me, it's just the embodiment of humanness in recognition of the other than human people, other than human creatures and lives out in the world. So, you know, if you looked up the dictionary definition, it might be the belief that everything has a spirit when people talk about animism. To me, that's, I don't necessarily look at the world in terms of spirits in the way that we in Western society have look at them. So for me, animism is really about recognizing all of the, seeing and interacting with the wills of all of the other things that are moving and flowing and living and dying and existing all around me all the time and inside of me and part of me. It's recognizing that there's a flow going there, and for the purpose of then rewilding, which would be to go with the flow, right? So to me, animism is about, it's the awareness of these flow systems, if you will, and rewilding is getting into those systems in a sense and creating a culture of embracing wildness. But if you can't see wildness, which I guess that's what animism to me is about, you know, animate moving things. You need to see those moving things and recognize that they exist before you can jump into that flow, right? And in our culture, we oftentimes think of the world as dead and static. And, you know, if you're viewing the world that way, you're not going to embody rewilding. You're going to just continue to embody domestication, the story of domestication.
Looks like that, what you just said may have triggered a question. Jessica asks, how does rewilding intersect with traditional indigenous knowledge of living in tune with the land?
So how does rewilding intersect with traditional ecological knowledge and living in tune with the land? I mean, that is what rewilding means. You know, there's the problem of domestication isn't something that started with capitalism. It's not something that started with in the Industrial Revolution. Domestication is a problem that, or challenge even, that humans all across the world have been dealing with for about 10,000 years. And different people around the world have discovered cultural solutions to work with this, essentially like a Pandora's box, right? Like domestication is this thing. Wow, humans can actually, we can kind of just do whatever we want. We can completely manipulate the land to our benefit and nobody else's. Traditional ecological knowledge is recognizing, to me, I'm going to say what I look at it as people who've already gone through this sort of gauntlet of recognizing the challenges that come with domestication and figuring out solutions for rewilding. So when I think about traditional ecological knowledge in regard to reciprocity, I think of people who, you know, the Mayans might be a great example. They reached a scale of domestication that was unsustainable, and their societies transitioned into a more resilient society. There's a great book called like Maya Forest Permaculture or something like, I forget the exact title, but it's about their regenerative principles, right? And in an interview once with Martine Prechtel, who lived with the Mayans for a decade or so in the 80s, He talks about this practice of theirs where they would take their corn seeds and cast them into the jungle. And then that's where they would gather corn seeds to plant for their farms, for their aspect of agriculture with their subsistence. And what that essentially they were doing was rewilding the corn. They were keeping corn vital and resilient by keeping the connections that it needed to have with the microbiome of the soil of the jungle, as well as all of the other wills that existed there. So the influence of, you know, part of the problem of domestication is this alienation from you know, the larger ecosystems that we're a part of. And so, you know, I have a little funny list here of techniques for embodied rewilding that I made. And the first, this relates to what we're talking about. So the first one is you have to have the story to embody before you can embody rewilding. You have to know what the rewilding story is. And then the second thing is weaving the cultural basket of rewilding. So it's that environmental psychology. It's understanding, you know, how to create an environment in which rewilding becomes part of the flow. It's about setting those boundaries, recognizing what are all the things that you need to have in place to make rewilding feel natural instead of feel like it's some self-help thing that's external to the rest of the world around you. And it's not like you could ever just, you know, the story of rewilding is constantly changing, right? And adapting and evolving. Just that's what rewilding is about. In the same way that creating a cultural basket of rewilding or cultural container to make rewilding function easier is also going to be something that's constantly changing. So it's not like you're checking off boxes here. It's each one of these is part of a cycle that you're constantly just adapting and changing each one and tweaking each one as you're building this whole thing. The third thing I wrote was leveraging resources and knowledge for your health and the health of your community. So, you know, there's a whole conversation around privilege that needs to happen in regards to things around rewilding, indigenous food sovereignty. You know, I talk about this a lot with people like in my classes, that rewilding is a crime to indigenous people, and it's a luxury for white people who live in a place where they can go out and hunt and gather and do all the things, you know, because they can buy the permits, because they're white and they look like everybody, because they have the wealth to take time off to go do those things, or they have the land to buy, to grow food on, et cetera. Whereas, you know, Standing Rock are indigenous people who are fighting for their lives to prevent water from being contaminated on the land in which they are, which they've dwelled for years immemorial. So this is time immemorial, right? And so you have this interesting conversation there about leveraging resources to help everybody rewild together, because we'll all get there together. We can't really pull ahead, you know, maybe pockets of privileged people with wealth can buy their way into a rewilding situation a lot easier than people who don't have that. But we should be thinking about this in regard to how to, this is everybody's birthright in a sense. And this is the challenge of humanity. So we have to figure out a way to get humanity there, not pockets of people who have a lot of money who can just buy land and then do whatever they want. So to me, leveraging our resources and knowledge for my personal health, for my community health, and then what's extra and giving all of that back. That's the fourth thing, is giving it all away, giving it back. And I think about this with all of the things that we're doing, even other than humans. And so in regard to this idea of like corn and rewilding and resilience, there's this taking of the corn and then the giving of it back, right? So there's this constant cycle of once you've opened that Pandora's box of domestication, how do you keep it regenerative culturally without going back down that rabbit hole or that slippery slope of you know, population explosions and degenerative practices. And then the fifth thing is just the repeating of the process, right? So a story, you know, number one, the story to embody. Number two, weaving the cultural basket. Number three, leveraging your resources and knowledge. Number four, giving it all away or back. And number five is in just repeating this process. And in the meantime, you know, I think about things like, you know, what the environment of evolutionary adaptation, and how I can eat better in that regard, how I can sleep better in that regard, and just kind of knowing these sort of quote unquote like life hacks to just keep me at a baseline where I can work on the systemic issues. So it's not like a wholehearted rejection of like those life hacks thing, but you have to question, you know, are these hacks making me feel wild, or are they actually helping me to be wild or rewild? And feeling wild is not actually doing any systemic work. It's not actually changing the culture at large. It's putting a Band-Aid on something that needs surgery or, you know, preventative medicine.
Just real briefly, we had a question about, Joan asks, could you please repeat the name of the Mayan book, the author Martin Prechtel? And
So Martin Prechtel has a series of books about his experiences living with Mayans. And I just highly, I mean, he's kind of the elder in my, I don't think, he doesn't really use the word rewilding. But you know, to me, he's like one of the elders of the rewilding movement for sure. All of his books, I would just recommend all of them. But there's a different one that's called The Maya Forest Garden. It's not by Martin Prechtel. It's by permaculturalists who went down there and were like, oh my God, these Mayan farmers have this whole system of regeneration in the way that they're acquiring food and subsisting, that is, you know, building the jungle and building the soil instead of degenerating the soil and having it wash away. Which, you know, if you're interested in kind of going down the rabbit hole of agriculture and its destructive, the inherent destructive aspect of just basic agriculture, the book, there's two books I'm going to recommend. One is Dirt, the Erosions of Civilizations. And the second one is Against the Grain by James C. Scott. So Against the Grain and Dirt, the Erosions of Civilizations. Those two are pretty good in regard to talking about how civilizations end up collapsing based on grain production and soil loss. Of course, I'd also make a plug for my own book. It's called Rewild or Die. And really, it's not like an ultimatum in that sense. It's really meant to be like rewild or bust. You know, for me, it's about that embodiment of rewilding. If I'm not rewilding, I'm not really interested. I mean, to me, that's just the only thing there is in life, is to understand what it means to be human and be in this humaning body. Or what's the point? That's kind of my premise. But Rewild or Die was written, you know, I wrote it when I was 25. And so it's about, geez, I don't know, 14 years old now. It's great. It was a blog compiled into a book. I'm working on another book on rewilding now that's more updated and recent. And, you know, who knows when that'll come out. But yeah, Rewild or Die. And then, of course, I'm going to plug my Rewilding 101 class. If you go to there's two websites, rewildportland.com or petermichaelbauer.com. And you can take my Rewilding 101 class. It's a lot of the stuff that we talked about today. There's lots of reading, group discussions, and lecture, all wrapped into sort of trying to understand what wildness is and what rewilding means. In that word that I used at the beginning, akadiwampal, toward wildness. So yeah, I'd like to open it up to Q&A now. And we got 10 minutes left, or 9 minutes or so. And yeah.
Actually, just 5 minutes, but yes, let's get some questions. Cool. Some folks are wondering about the five habits of embodying that you mentioned. I see Jones put in the chat, embody the story, weave a cultural basket, level resources and knowledge, give it all away, give it all back, five, repeat. Was there anything missing from that list, or is that correct?
I mean, of course, there's a million things missing. Mm-hmm. You know, take that list, chew on it for a while, and then throw it away. Come up with your own thing, right? I hate anything that's prescriptive. So of course, this is the closest thing I'm gonna get. It's vague, and it's more about you on your own, using this as a tool for your own journey of exploration into what wildness really means.
All Oh, it looks like we have another question. Roz asks, how do small regenerative community farms fit into your idea of rewilding? Not big agro growing grains, but organic farms with diverse plants, vegetables, food forests, et cetera.
Yeah, I think permaculture, permacultural farms, or even like regenerative agriculture farms are already, you know, way ahead of the game. But even then, there's still sort of a slippery slope of coming back to, you know, a degenerative way of life. You know, even the first organic farms in the Middle East, in a sense, they were doing all the things of regenerative agriculture, and they still depleted their soil in the end. So I think that there's a real importance in recognizing, you know, I love permaculture, but permaculture really is just people from a domesticated worldview seeing indigenous horticulture and then framing it around through their own lens of trying to get back to horticulture. So, and rewilding is very similar in that regard, except that it has a critique of civilization and prehistory, and it delves into what it means to be human, how we fit into ecosystems, as opposed to, you know, permaculture is a design science. So I think about, but rewilding is a narrative. Rewilding is a story to embody. Permaculture is a design science. So once you understand the story of rewilding, you can use permaculture to rewild, but you don't have to, you know, there are people here who have the same kind of domesticated mindset who use permaculture with that mindset, and it doesn't lead toward wildness. So I think that, you know, for me personally, like if you were to really go hard in permaculture and go all the way down the rabbit hole, you would get to rewilding, but I don't think most people end up going down that rabbit hole.
So would one of the attendees, Crescent the Grant Great, asked, what exactly is the wildness story that I need to embody? What's a good link for the details? Would a good link be the Rewilding 101 class? Is that,
yeah,
or is there?
I mean, I, you know, everything that I've been talking about in the last hour is part of the story of rewilding, the narrative to live by. And so, you know, some of that is in my book, Rewild or Die. If you want, you know, I would recommend checking that out. If you want the most updated version of that, then the 101 class is a great place to start. And there isn't a class listed yet on there for next month, but we will be offering one in November. And I offer them periodically, you know, month to month usually. So if you just sign up to the email list or check back to the Rewild Portland website regularly, you'll get a chance at seeing when the next 101 session is happening. And I like to change them time zone wise, because I'm here in Pacific Standard Time, but there's people in, you know, Europe who want to take it, in Australia. So I try to move around the time so I can hit different parts of the world that at least are English speaking, because I don't speak other languages yet, other than Chinook Wawa. I speak the native trade language here, but I don't speak, you know, languages that are elsewhere in the world other than English.
Well, so that's, hold on, don't go anywhere yet, Peter, but that's about it for our time. I'm posting in the chat that after we close the Zoom session, there's a coffee break at the Embodiment Conference portal. There's more discussion on the Facebook page, Embodiment Conference. Thank you so much, Peter, for
thank you.
All this amazing information. You got some nice compliments in the chat, so make sure to check them out. you can purchase these recordings if you want to have them beyond the 48 hours. And one, how about Peter, one last thing from you, your top tip on being more embodied from a rewilding perspective.
I can't give a single thing. It's too complex.
Yes,
everyone. I'm sorry. You've got to dive deep in this rabbit hole. Just go down. Just come
that's
down.
That's a great tip. Dive deep into the rabbit hole.
Come down the rabbit hole.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm also on Facebook and Instagram. So, you know, seek me out there. You can just find me by searching my name. I'm constantly posting random thoughts in those places in regard to rewilding. So.
All right. A big thanks to Peter and to everybody who came and provided questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. That was great. Really interesting. Yeah, yeah. So I guess I'll end the session now.
All right.
Unless there's anything else that you want to wind up with or.
I'm good. Yeah, I'll probably head over to the Facebook group thing, and if anybody wants to chat with me over there.
Okay, great. Nice one. Yeah. Cool. And just to let you know that I wasn't able to put it live on the Facebook page because I hadn't been, I've had a request waiting. And so I'm not part of the group yet. That'll probably come through now. But yeah, cool. Yeah. But there's a recording. And as soon as I press end, that'll go to the library. Yeah, nice work. Nice one. Really interesting. Yeah.
Thank you.
Glad to have been here. All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you then. Bye.